From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with a question. Do you consider yourself a climate nihilist? In other words, do you think that nothing we do is going to matter, that humans are going to fail, and climate change is going to cause catastrophic harm beyond what it has already caused? Have you given up? In the pages of the new edition of The New Yorker, author Jonathan Franzen makes the case for a kind of climate nihilism. Franzen opens his piece with this, quote, "If you're younger than 60, you have a good chance of witnessing the radical destabilization of life on Earth, massive crop failure, apocalyptic fires, imploding economies, epic flooding, hundreds of millions of refugees fleeing regions made uninhabitable by extreme heat or permanent drought. And if you're under 30, you're all but guaranteed to witness this." End quote. Franzen asserts that there are two ways to think about this. You can keep on hoping that catastrophe is preventable and feel ever more frustrated or enraged by the world's inaction, or you can accept that disaster is coming and begin to rethink what it means to have hope. He writes that human beings are really not going to change, not fast enough, not enough. He concludes, quote, "If you accept the reality that the planet will soon overheat to the point of threatening civilization entirely, there's a whole lot more you should be doing," end quote. But he's not talking about slowing climate change. He's talking about making life more pleasant while climate disaster occurs. But the experts in the field are not happy with Franzen. They point out that his piece contains many errors about the reality and the consensus about climate change. Professor Leah Stokes rips Franzen for reducing climate action to a binary. Either it stops climate change entirely or everything burns. Stokes writes, quote, "Every molecule of carbon counts. Every tenth of a degree warming avoided counts. What we do matters. And guess what? Franzen, as usual, is doing nothing to help us do better," end quote. And she rips Franzen for writing that accepting the Green New Deal means Americans have to accept diminished lifestyle and higher taxes. Stokes says the whole point of the Green New Deal is to avoid those outcomes. Well, this hour, a debate about climate nihilism, where our attention should be, and what is still possible. Our guests include in studio Abigail McHugh Griffa. Abby is Executive Director of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan is here, Lead Minister at First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Reverend, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
And on the line with us is Dr. Genevieve Gunther, Founder and Director of EndClimateSilence.org. Dr. Gunther, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what End Climate Silence is?
Yeah, End Climate Silence is a group that is trying to encourage the media to mention climate change with the frequency and the urgency that it deserves. Too often we see stories in print journalist outlets and also on the news, the television news networks, where they'll report on extreme weather or a heat wave or some other effect of climate change and never mention climate change at all. Not connecting the dots is keeping, you know, people uninformed and disengaged, and it needs to stop now because climate change is happening and the news media has a responsibility to report that fact.
Now, Dr. Gunther, I'll start with you for a reaction to the Franzen piece. For listeners, there's a couple of reasons we're having this conversation this hour. First of all, Jonathan Franzen is one of the best-selling authors in the country. The New Yorker has a wide circulation. A lot of people are going to read this piece and probably wonder, you know, I don't know, are we really going to fail? We're not going to do what we need to do. I also understand psychologically why people feel a kind of nihilism, and I use that term because it comes from a comedian named Bridget Phetasy, who was watching the CNN 7-hour climate change town hall last week and tweeted that none of this matters. And she called herself a climate nihilist. She says it's all going to be for naught, that we're not going to do what is required. And that's basically where Franzen is. But I'll start with you, Dr. Gunther. What did you make of the piece itself?
Well, I had three different problems with the piece. First, it distorted the science. He is not giving an accurate picture of what the science says will happen if we cross the 2C boundary of warming. The other problem I had with it was that it was completely apolitical. Like, it doesn't have an idea of political change and how that change might happen. And because Franzen lacks that idea, he imagines that it means the political change won't happen. Furthermore, he looks back at the past 30 years since science started sounding the alarm about climate change, and he sees that we haven't reduced emissions. In fact, emissions have been growing. But he doesn't understand the politics of that fact, the fact that the fossil fuel industry has teamed up with politicians, not only to distort the scientific facts and create doubt among the public, but to literally block any kind of climate policy from passing on both the state and the federal levels. So this has been a political fight all along. We aren't further along, not because we have some sort of inherent desire to destroy ourselves or inability to stop burning fossil fuels. We aren't further along because there's been this political fight that's been happening that we have been losing. But that doesn't mean we have to continue to lose the fight. Okay. So those, and then my third problem is that he also contradicts himself. He imagines in the piece that we're going to have this widespread apocalyptic breakdown of our climate system, but then he also sort of imagines that we'll all be able to have farmers markets and, you know, local agriculture that will bring us closer to our neighbors. And I don't really understand how he imagines those two things simultaneously. And I think that speaks to the fact that he hasn't thought any of this through. And I don't think people really should listen to him as an authority on climate because he gets the science wrong and he gets the politics wrong.
Well, what Dr. Gunther is referring to is sort of the, I confess I agree, the bizarre way the piece ends in which Franzen talks about this farmer's market that is kind of bringing a community closer together and getting people more connected while acknowledging that eventually food is basically going to be wiped out by climate change and saying, well, at least we can do farmer's markets for a little while. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but it was sort of a bizarre conclusion. And the best I can make of that, Dr. Gunther, is what he's really saying is that's what gives him comfort. His imagination doesn't go very far beyond that. And for now, let's love each other and do things a little closer to home and be more connected until there's nothing left of our planet here. And I guess
that's exactly what he's saying. I think you've characterized it perfectly. And to me, that's a moral abomination. You know, I'm a mother. And even if you're not a mother, you may love this world and the other people in it. And you may want there to be a future for other people. And you want to fight for that because it's the right thing to do. And also because we still have time to stave off the worst effects of climate change. And there's been so much change just in the past 18 months. If someone had said 2 years ago that CNN would have a 7-hour program about climate change and that the ratings for that program would be better during the primetime slot than what CNN usually airs, I wouldn't have believed it. What's changed is just unimaginable so far. And that's the way systems change. It happens very slowly and then it happens all at once.
Abby, you've been working on this for a number of years and you've shared your own personal story and your professional story on this program. And so I'm wondering when you read Franzen talking about essentially kind of giving up and shifting attention away from averting climate catastrophe and more towards ameliorating the impacts while we can, what do you think?
So I read this article with great interest, you know, and I would recommend that people really do sit down and read it. Because while, yes, some of the, you know, there's some drama in there in the writing, right? And some hyperbole, certainly. But, you know, Franzen, he doesn't present himself as a climate science expert. He presents himself as a regular guy who's exploring these issues and wrestling with these issues and trying to find his place in it. And I can definitely relate to that, you know, as someone who came to this as a, you know, a music teacher who was concerned and trying to figure out what to do and is still wrestling with that. You know, certainly his position that, you know, half measures are better than nothing, that doesn't satisfy me. You know, I feel that we have a moral obligation to do everything we possibly can to avert this crisis. Just giving up halfway or saying half measures are okay, that's not acceptable to me whatsoever. But I do appreciate his interest in having difficult conversations about climate. And I think he makes a good point about how, you know, politicians, scientists, activists, and kind of across the board do often sugarcoat to some extent, you know, the magnitude of the crisis we're facing. And we wrestle with that in our work. And so I think it is important that we have those hard conversations, not scientifically inaccurate conversations, but that we acknowledge that we have really difficult choices to make and we need to carefully examine our priorities.
So in other words, if I'm reading you right here, you're kind of done with this idea that, hey, I drive a Prius, so, you know, we're good. That it's going to be maybe hard. There's going to be hard choices. And in a moment, and I know Dr. Gunther will want to jump in on this too, we can have a conversation about what hard means, because Franzen sort of assumes that we're going to have to give up just about everything we love. And I'm not sure we're going to have to do that. But it sounds like you think, Abby, we've spent the last 15, 20 years trying to tell people, you know, change your light bulbs, you know, as opposed to the systemic change that might be politically harder, might be harder systemically, but is still doable. Yeah. No more sugarcoating.
So let me give you a concrete local example.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the city's comprehensive plan, there's actually a lot in that plan to be optimistic about in terms of the vision for the future and specifically around climate issues, environmental issues. There's also been a lot of pushback on that plan regarding things like zoning changes that would impact parking, the availability of parking spaces, right? Neighborhood groups, merchants associations, you know, in the city newspaper last week, there was a letter specifically from merchant association about how the limiting parking spaces was going to impact business, impact property values, impact all these things. And so, you know, how does our local government respond to that? They've put out this draft plan, which actually has a lot to like from a climate perspective. Everyday citizens are pushing back kind of because it will change life right here today as we know it and the way we do things and are accustomed to living. And yeah, there, you know, with any change, there's going to be unintended consequences and
sure.
Even intended consequences that maybe not everyone loves. So how does the mayor respond to that? Does she say, okay, we'll keep the parking? Or does she say, no, actually, this climate thing is real. We need to dramatically transform our transportation system. That's going to be politically unpopular in many circles, but it is, from my perspective, very much the right choice. Do our elected leaders have the courage to do that? And I hope in this particular case, the answer is yes. I think in many instances, we see that the answer is no. So that's the kind of conversation and willingness to say, well, actually, we will need to change the way we live. And there's an argument to be made for why that approach is better and will benefit us in other ways in the future. But, you know, from the right here today, people's resistance to change can be difficult, you know, for politicians and everyday folks to stomach.
Okay. Reverend, how do you feel about what you read?
Yeah, so I think what Abby so perfectly cues up here and what Franzen imperfectly and quite frankly probably implicitly and irresponsibly leads us to ask is, what are we saving, right? What drives him so quickly into despair, into this sense of nihilism, is that if we can't maintain and save the lifestyle that has created this problem, that has maintained the political and social challenges to making widespread change, then it's no longer worth saving. At least that's the binary that Stokes points out is so difficult to grapple with when scientists and communities who have gone through major changes are saying, nope, actually there's a huge amount of difference in that range, right? So what did I think of the article, I think was your question. I think it raises some good questions for us in terms of what we'll need to change. I don't draw the same conclusion that Franzen does, but I think it helps us hopefully have a deeper conversation around what is it that we need to be clear about where we're headed.
Yeah, and Reverend, one of the reasons we wanted to have you here is because, you know, your work on social justice, social issues, and faith, I mean, I assume you've talked to many people who grapple with a loss of hope. Pain, fear of the future, fear of loss. And so as it moves into the sphere, as it moves into climate, I'm curious to know if you at least find Franzen's sort of raise the white flag attitude relatable, if not acceptable. Do you see that in other ways? And then do you find ways to maybe grapple with that more effectively than he is?
Yeah, well, so I think where religious resources then become really critical in this conversation is, and this is going to be grim, so stick with me. It's going to start grim And then, unlike Franzen, we're going to go somewhere better, though hopefully better than farmers markets. So I like a good farmers market.
I do too. Yeah, we're not dogging farmers market, just to be clear. But
right.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So what religious traditions teach us, and not all religious traditions, but it's a fairly common one, it grapples with the reality of death, right? So when we talk about climate catastrophe or change or the ways in which making our home and our relationship to this planet has shifted, we can also talk about the universal human experience of everyone that you know and love, including yourself, is either dead or will be, right? That is true at any point in human history. And that religions and Unitarian Universalism, specifically, that's a tradition that I'm grounded in, then responds to that reality, to that sense of despair and hope and suffering. And you're looking at me like, Sherry, where are you going with this? And that's a totally reasonable sort of quizzical look that you're giving me, because why am I talking about that? I think that's that way in which Franzen deals with, there's this thing that's scary that may or may not be real. He sees it as an absolute possibility. We're hearing from scientists that actually every tenth of a degree matters a ton. But the reality of change is at this point not disputed.
Sure.
So in the same way that religion and my personal experience asks us then in times of despair, so when somebody has died, I've taken an extreme example. That acknowledgement then opens up a space for agency, where, as I think it was Dr. Stokes who you were quoting earlier, what we do matters. What we do matters a lot. And we see that then in other realms of human experience. I think the same thing applies here, right? Given this truth of we have a limited amount of time, how are we going to spend it? And again, what are we saving? What are we fighting for? Those are questions that are at the very core of how we approach any issue.
Yeah. Abby, go ahead. And then I want to turn back to Dr. Gunther. But go ahead, Abby.
You know, it's really interesting to hear, you know, that religious perspective. Because for someone who's not particularly religious or spiritual, one thing this really brought strongly to mind, actually, is the Serenity Prayer. Right. And that's not a place I go usually. But, you know, if you're not familiar with the Serenity Prayer, of course, that's the God grant us. What is it? Should you take this over maybe? But so the serenity, accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Mm-hmm. And wow, that is a great guiding framework mm-hmm. for this climate issue. And, you know, Franzen, I think he specifically says, you know, you can accept that disaster is coming and to begin to rethink what it means to have hope. And, you know, the degree of disaster we're talking about, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We do know that this climate change thing is already in the works. As he accurately acknowledges, we cannot stop climate change. We're not going to solve it completely, right? This has been put in motion. We are already seeing impact. We will continue to see impacts. So we have to wrestle with what can we change, what can't we change, and then that mitigation versus adaptation question comes in, and it is important that we be having conversations about that.
So, listeners, if you want to join the conversation with whether you consider yourself a climate nihilist and whether you're resisting that within yourself, that despair you might feel and what that means, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. And on that note, I want to turn back to Dr. Genevieve Gunther, who's on the line with us, the founder and director of endclimatesilence.org. Let me read an email from Alex in Rochester who says, as a card-carrying millennial and recent climate nihilist, I don't think Franzen is out of line. 40 years of conservation efforts under neoliberal politicking haven't appreciably resulted in truly reformative policy. Franzen is not a scientist, but as an author and artist, the art he creates has the potential to change public perception. Gradual change is great, but for those who are facing such a dire future, I'm okay to write off a little hyperbole. That comes from Alex. Dr. Gunther, what do you make of that?
Well, I wonder why someone who complains about neoliberal politics has such an affinity for this article, which to me exemplifies the kind of neoliberal individualism that imagines consumer choices have a kind of ethical valence, that if we grow our own food or if we buy using a cloth instead of a plastic bag, somehow that signals our virtue, and that allows us to feel like we've done everything that we can do. And what neoliberalism is out, from my perspective, is an idea of banding together and using our labor power to force the people who actually have the power to prevent the kind of future that Franzen envisions from coming to place, prevent them from allowing that future to happen. So if I may, yeah. I just want to clarify something. I want to be very clear about this. It is the case that we are going to have a massive influx of immigrants coming north because the tropics are going to become increasingly difficult to farm and people are going to start starving. This has already started to happen in Guatemala and Honduras, et cetera, and it's only going to get worse even if we halt warming at 2 degrees Celsius or a little bit above it. Yes, there is going to have to retreat from the coasts. And yes, many things we love are going to get destroyed. It's going to be bad. But that is not what Franzen is telling us. And I'm going to quote from the article directly. This is what he's telling us. And I quote, "Our atmosphere and oceans can absorb only so much heat before climate change, intensified by various feedback loops, spins completely out of control. The consensus among scientists and policymakers is that we'll pass this point of no return if the global mean temperature rises by more than 2 degrees Celsius, maybe a little more, but also maybe a little less." Okay, that is not accurate. That is flat out wrong. So what Franzen is arguing is that we are going to hit 2 degrees Celsius and our climate system is going to spin out of control and there's nothing we can do about that. This is false, and we must not give up the fight before we've even started. What we have to do is find groups that are organizing politically in order to force the people in power to stop blocking climate action, precisely because we don't want our climate system to heat up so much that it is going to spin out of control, and then there will be nothing to save. So I think it's very important not to think in these black and white terms, which Franzen, I think, is doing. And it's very important to both understand that we're facing something horrific, even at 2 degrees Celsius. And there is a lot of grief and fear and despair that all of us are going to have to cope with in order to take up climate change as a political cause. But at the same time, we are still able to, as Professor Soak says, stave off so much death, stave off so much suffering, stave so many things that we love, because every tenth of a degree matters.
Yeah, so Dr. Gunther, I that makes me think of the recent the CNN town hall on climate, in which there was a moment when Elizabeth Warren, I think, was the one who was asked about, you know, they say that you're going to take away their hamburgers. And she didn't take mm-hmm. she didn't take the bait there. And I thought this was a very instructive moment, because I don't want listeners to think that we are overly political here. But I do think it's OK to evaluate whether certain kinds of discourse may make the debate sort of dumber or mm-hmm. or intentionally distracted. And what I would say about the whole hamburger thing is this: there's going to be policy conversation about what we ought to, you know, how big your house should be and how much energy output is appropriate for a family of four and how we get around in transportation. But those are systemic level questions. And the notion of making someone scared that they won't be able to get a hamburger if you elect somebody is a good way to distract from a conversation about what would need to happen or not happen systemically. And Elizabeth Warren did not take that bait. She redirected it immediately to, hey, do what you can individually, but this is mostly a systemic thing, which I thought was more helpful. I mean, I'm not endorsing any individual policy over another. But mm-hmm. Dr. Gunther, do you agree that that is a better way to talk about this now? You know, no offense to those who are trying to do the little things, which is great, but that we've got to talk systemically?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, there is no, even if everyone brought their personal carbon emissions down as far as they could within the current constraints of the way that we've built up our societies, we would not stop climate change because it would not be enough, right? You can't ask people not to drive to Wegmans when there's no other way to get to Wegmans, right? So yes, individuals have to start thinking about how to reduce their carbon footprints, but we need to rebuild infrastructure and make new ways of getting ourselves around, of generating electricity, of not being forced to waste food because we can only buy it in these massive quantities if it's going to be affordable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are all of these things where businesses and governments need to set up the structure first in which individuals can act. So yes, I agree. This messaging about hamburgers, all these things that we enjoy that are going to be taken away from us if we, you know, finally get off the starting block, all of these things that are going to be taken away from us, that is, in fact, fossil fuel company messaging. They want to keep everybody's attention on what we are afraid we're going to lose so that we can't think about what we're going to lose if we don't do this, and also what we could possibly gain by rebuilding things so that people aren't obligated to spend money on gas that they don't have and do have an option to take public transportation that isn't depressing and will get them to where they want to go and get them home quickly. So I agree. It's a systemic problem. And it's not that, you know, it's not that you have to be a Democrat or a Republican to recognize this, because Republicans have different ways of approaching systemic solutions. Democrats have different ways of approaching systemic solutions. But we need everybody at the table to do this together.
Talking about Jonathan Franzen's piece in The New Yorker, which you might have seen, about the idea that climate change catastrophe is coming and that we should shift our attention to dealing with it as opposed to trying to prevent it, just pragmatically. Now, Franzen has been criticized by a lot of people, but we're trying to talk about this hour what it means to kind of push back against the idea that it's hopeless and what can actually be done, what is still within reach. After our only break of the hour, we're going to get back to your phone calls and feedback for our guests here. You just heard Dr. Genevieve Gunther, the founder and director of EndClimateSilence.org. Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan is here, lead minister at First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Abby McHugh Griffith is the executive director of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and your phone calls are next. Coming up in our second hour, Midtown Athletic Club is one of the most expensive in town, and it's setting out on a 3-year expansion project. They asked for taxpayer support to do the expansion, and Monroe County says this is a very good investment. Midtown's going to create new full and part-time jobs, and that means the tax break goes a long way. But the critics say it's the wrong place to support with taxpayer money. They debate it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rich in Rochester is first on our phones. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan. How are you doing today?
Well, I don't know, man. I mean, good, I guess, for now. How are you?
I'm doing good. I think I liken the discussion. I think part of the problem, though, is, and I've said this before on your show, we have to talk to people's personal feelings in the sense of, I think, From my perspective, phrases like save the earth or save the world doesn't help, because it's not about the world. It's about us and how we want this world to be for us, because the world really doesn't care. There's so many things going on here. Like, I don't know how any of this is sustainable as long as our populations keep growing, because every human being needs resources to live. We have to start looking at this pragmatically and real. And tackle those problems and look at the bottom line with all this stuff. If we end up with 8 billion people on this earth, where are we going to get 15% more resources to feed those people, to clothe them? And also, within the United States, how do we say, no, the rest of the world can't use as many BTUs per hour as we use? All these questions are hard questions. And also, how many people are really willing to give up or to change their habits and the systems that we use, i.e. Mm-hmm. going to full public transportation, becoming as efficient as we can?
Yeah.
These are hard questions, and I don't know if we have the capacity right now to solve them with all the constant miscommunications and basically many lies told about these things. That's my worry, is that we're not, humanity is not willing to do what it takes until it's going to be, pardon the count, the term, but too late.
Yeah.
I think the term is real.
Yeah. So Rich, what I'm going to do there, I really appreciate that, Rich. I'm going to refer to something Franzen says to help pivot this to our guests. But first, let me also say there's really interesting research on happiness. how much money do you need to make to be happy? And there's really interesting research about diminishing returns, because for some reason, for generations, we've sort of trained ourselves to think like the more and more and more you get, and the bigger and bigger, bigger your house is. And I'm not sitting here saying don't make money, don't have a nice house. But there's really interesting research that says there are diminishing returns, generally speaking, on happiness. And we've trained ourselves to think that more is always good. So when Jonathan Franzen writes that for this to happen, for us to avert 2C, that the world's major polluting countries would have to institute, quote, draconian conservation measures. I think that's a very loaded term, draconian. Mm-hmm. If you had cancer and the doctor told you that if you ate a greasy hamburger every day, and then this is totally just me making this up, that a greasy hamburger every day is fueling your cancer growth, and to slow the cancer growth, change what you eat, I don't think you'd walk out of the office and be like, well, that's draconian. I think you would say, it's pragmatic, and guess what? Good news. I'm capable of making this change. Might be hard. I might crave that burger for a while, but eventually I'll get used to not eating that burger every night. So that would not necessarily be draconian. It would be smart, maybe difficult, but within the realm of doable. We've trained ourselves to think about, you know, more is always better. But here's what Franzen has to write about what Rich just said, what humans are doing. He writes, quote, overwhelming numbers of human beings, including millions of government-hating Americans, need to accept high taxes and severe curtailment of their familiar lifestyles without revolting. They must accept the reality of climate change and have faith in the extreme measures taken to combat it. They can't dismiss news they dislike as fake. They have to set aside nationalism and class and racial resentment. They have to make sacrifices for distant threatened nations and distant future generations. They have to be permanently terrified by hotter summers and more frequent natural disasters rather than just getting used to them. Every day, instead of thinking about breakfast, they have to think about death, end quote. That's Franzen. Let's let's go around the table. Dr. Gunther, I'll start with you. You're laughing at that.
I'm completely laughing because he doesn't understand climate policy, right? I mean, part of the point here is that switching out your gas-guzzling car that breaks down every 5 minutes and is stinky and hard to maintain for an EV that has fewer piece, you know, components and is easier to repair and maintain and is nice and silent and not stinky, that doesn't seem like such a sacrifice to me. And I understand that people don't necessarily have a bunch of cash in their bank accounts to buy an EV, but part of climate policy is well, one candidate for president, who I will not name to not seem political, has suggested that there should be grants to help people turn in their internal combustion engine cars and turn to EVs. That's just one example of a way in which climate policy might not actually be draconian. It might actually make our lives better. So this vision that he has of everybody just suffering and then having this kind of conversion experience to think of distant nations and distant generations is just false, especially because, as we all have acknowledged already on this program, the effects of climate change are no longer distant. They are very much coming home to people in the Midwest whose farms were flooded, to people in California who are subjected to wildfires every summer, to people in Florida who are already having to retreat, to, you know, to all of us, essentially. And it just, it's a fantasy that the effects of climate change are going to ever feel comfortable and normal, especially not if what Franzen says is even remotely true. So I think the picture that he's painting is actually inaccurate. It's dangerous, and it does the work of the people who are trying to block the kind of systemic change that we can get from banding together collectively to force our politicians to save us and our children.
Yeah, and Reverend, I wonder if there's a kind of some spiritual crisis work that needs to be done here. And I don't want to project on Franzen, but his piece strikes me as this limited idea that, well, I've got a big house, and what if we have to have smaller houses? Like, can you imagine a world? I mean, like, it's almost like this idea that everything we know and love is going to be, as opposed to just change and pragmatic change. But I wonder how we address that from sort of healing what we expect of what we're owed, what we deserve, what makes us happy.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I've already confessed that I don't think thinking about death is a bad thing. So maybe Franzen and I are lining up on opposite sides there. But I appreciate the clarity of the last comment, because when we talk about sort of what's at stake, a big house versus the lives of lots of people, you know, we're already seeing waves of migration linked to climate. Let's get really clear about the stakes. And it does feel incredibly selfish to say, I might have to give up this thing that I've gotten used to, right? To your point of happiness being linked to greater and greater consumption, and we know that that's not true, that mm-hmm. there are diminishing returns, that there's a limit to that. This is, you know, certainly still rooted in social science, but from a more religious perspective, you know, on the other side of happiness research, we have Viktor Frankl talking about man's search for meaning, and that mm-hmm. happiness is as something we look at straight and drive towards is rarely successful in achieving happiness. That we are happy, and you know, he says man, but let's say all peoples, are happiest when we have something that matters that we're doing, that other people notice when we show up, and that it makes a difference whether or not we did the thing that we set out to do. And so for Franzen to just give up decimates that possibility of happiness.
Abby, how do you feel about this idea of making it more personal, as Rich says?
So I guess why don't I just do that? Because I think this conversation about happiness, about human nature and how human nature plays into all this, because we are a pretty critical piece of this puzzle, right? Like what's going to happen does depend on our inner workings and how we navigate a lot of human, you know, just social dynamics. But for me personally, I can 100% speak to the truth of pursuing climate solutions, and at times that means a simpler lifestyle does lead to greater happiness, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I started in my journey as a climate activist, I think I was more on that path of pursuing the big house and the nicer car and the, I don't know, prestigious job title or whatever it was, you know, having things, accumulating things with the idea that that would make me happy. And, you know, that's an idea so many of us buy into because it's basically what we've been sold on television since we were born. And when I made the conscious decision to take a different path, boy, I've just been literally happier ever since. I mean, it mm-hmm. feels good to know that you're living your values. As soon as you, you know, recognize in yourself that the natural world and the people in it are something you value and you want to dedicate yourself to making life better for people on Earth and other species too, of course, there's some real satisfaction in then living that. And it did not just come like automatically overnight, you know, to me to figure out how does one actually do that. And I think that's maybe the missing piece for some people. You know, they know that they want to make a difference on climate. They know that they care about future generations, but they're not actually sure how to operationalize that in their daily lives. And so they do start, of course, typically with those personal lifestyle changes that reduce your carbon footprint. Maybe it's driving less, maybe it's eating less meat, maybe it's turning your thermostat down a little bit. They start there. And then hopefully we're all kind of moving along the spectrum to prioritizing systems level solutions, right? Thinking about how do we not just keep it, you know, quiet in our own home what we're doing, but how do we change the social norms? You know, once mm-hmm. once you know that your neighbor is interested in these things and your neighbor is saving energy, that can be inspirational, you know, kind of across the neighborhood. So, and it right here in the city of Rochester, when we think about this locally, a lot of the challenges that we face as a community can be addressed in tandem with implementing climate solutions. So poverty. Poverty is a really big problem locally. Well, as soon as we, you know, improve the energy efficiency of people's housing units, well, there we've saved them a little money on their utility bills. And that is just one small example, and there are many examples, of how we can improve people's lives while also protecting our climate.
All right, listeners, let's get back to your phone calls. Jack in Greece is next. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, Evan, just a couple of thoughts. Is it Dr. Gunther?
Yep.
I really appreciate the clarity of just saying it's basically we're giving up before we have even tried. To me, I think that's right on target. We haven't, in my opinion, yes, we've done things in our country, but we really haven't tried. We have, not to turn this into a political conversation, but you can't help but go there when we have a president and an administration that basically says this, it's not true. It's fake news. It's made up by somebody else for some advantage. And the fact that we have so much cheap energy available in the ground that people are just going to pump out and make billions of dollars off of and feed political campaigns, we haven't even really tried in our country. I can remember back when I had to write a paper in college in the 60s, and I happened to write it on pollution. And I had to read all sorts of articles about water pollution and air pollution, and it seemed insurmountable. But yet, when we had acid rain in the Adirondacks, people that were in power said, we could never afford this. We can't afford to generate electricity and have clean air at the same time. We had to let the smokestacks put all of this stuff out in the air. Well, what's happened? Miraculously, we've managed to afford that. We've cleaned up the lakes and the Adirondacks, but nobody talks about that now. But that happened in our lifetime. To me, it's just, for lack of a better word, it's so un-American to say we can't do this without even trying. Yeah, it's so easy to sit back and say, yeah, I'm going to have my big house, my air, whatever I want to have, and I'm just going to forget about the future. Well, anybody that has children, grandchildren, has to care about the future. I can't put it any other way but how unselfish it is. We can do great things as a country, but when we have leadership like we have today, we have to address that first. We should be able to make data-driven decisions. I had to do that at work. Why can't we do that on something as life-threatening and as critical to our future as climate change? We have, I think it's the state of Florida, that doesn't even allow the words global warming or climate change in any of the government documents. Talk about putting your head in the sand and not even getting off the dime to start. That's it in a nutshell. And it's just unbelievable that we have countries in Europe that are taking a lead, and we're willing to give that up just so we can suck this stuff out of the ground. That's my opinion. Thanks for listening.
Jack, thank you. I appreciate that phone call. Dr. Gunther, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
Well, I agree with everything that was just said, and I appreciate the caller's clarity as well. I think the example of treating the acid rain crisis is an excellent one. And I think it's really important to remember that again and again, when industries are called to account for externalizing their costs onto the rest of us and just not being willing to do what it takes in order to, proceed so that other people aren't hurt by their business, they always say that it's too hard, that it can't be done, that the problem is just too overwhelming. And then it can get done. I think that we really need to remember that if we give up, right, we've seeded the ground from the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, Abby, it's Adam Frank in his book argued here in Rochester that we are absolutely an innovative species, and we've proven it. So this notion of giving up and not getting off the starting block. So when Jack says, for lack of a better term, it's un-American to give up, you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And it's not empowering to give up either, right? Like, let's take charge a little bit more of our own fate and our own destiny. The one thing that in the article I thought that was brought up, though, that was interesting was the idea of not relying on high-tech solutions, that we need to not just bank on the big, huge, renewable energy generation installations, but that there are simple things we can do as well that are also very effective. Planting trees, that is a really proven technology that has all kinds of other benefits and really no hidden consequences. So I appreciate that came out of the article and wouldn't want to lose that in this conversation.
Okay. Sherry, how do you feel about the idea that, you know, Jack feels like we can do so much, but he does feel like when it comes to the structures and power, it's such an obstacle. I mean, I've got a couple of emails from listeners saying that, not to make this overly political, but if Donald Trump wins again next year, they can't see climate policy surviving enough, you know, to make a real impact in, quote unquote, in time. What do you say?
Right. I mean, leadership certainly matters. There's no doubt about that. And I don't think Americans have the have cornered innovation or gumption, right? I mean, the divine right of kings in European history is something that existed and felt unchallengeable and is not a thing that continues, right? I mean, to go with a historical example that I think Ursula K. Le Guin would use a lot. But in any case, these historical moments, some of which are quite recent, when we can point to times in which a group of people have made a change, it is empowering. It allows us to shift and to move and to change. I mean, and to Abby's point earlier of lots of climate solutions are also solutions to other problems, I think that helps us understand that it's not, these are not insurmountable challenges, that there's more broad-based support than we realize. What is American is that we have an incredible capacity for disagreement, right? So the American Revolution may not be complete, but when we think about no longer being a colony of England or Great Britain, right? Only about a third of people in the colonies were supportive of that, right? So we don't actually need everyone to make massive social and political change.
Mm-hmm. An important point there. Dave writes to say, by the way, Dave writes from Vancouver, Canada, who's listening via a mobile app, which everyone should have as a matter of policy and personal choice. Dave says, I'm a bit unusual in that I've long been taking personal action. I have not eaten meat since 1989. I've not flown since 1993. I've not driven a car since 2006. And he's been the long head of an environmental organization, he says. And he writes, clearly, I'm very lucky to have been a respected academic in the past, such that I could get away with not flying to conferences, etc. Although, without doubt, that adversely affected my career. I also live in a city with excellent public transportation. He says, I find living simply in the face of what we are up against very definitely making me wildly more happy than I would be had I continued living as I had done earlier. That's an approach for personal happiness that I would highly recommend to our society as a whole, and we must work as hard as we can to get the very necessary governmental action in place. That's from Dave, who's the executive director of Earth Save Canada, listening from Vancouver. Dave, thank you as always for the feedback and just another bullet point, so to speak, when it comes to personal habits, systemic habits, and happiness. But I also want to ask our guests one more question that comes from a listener. We've had a number of questions about, you know, what people can do personally without actual structural governmental change. And I'm going to ask Dr. Gunther first on this. I've got some listeners who don't even think the Democrats are providing necessary leadership. There's been a lot of talk about Donald Trump and the Trump administration and Republicans and Franzen rips Republicans, but a feeling of dissatisfaction with Democrats as well, and that is what is driving some nihilism as well. In other words, mm-hmm. Where are the political heroes? Where are the leaders, as the Reverend says, maybe not in either party in some ways, and that has driven some nihilism. What do you say to that, Dr. Gunther?
I can see that point of view. I have not been very happy with the DNC, for example, who refused to hold a climate debate, acting like the climate was just a niche issue or one among every issue. As we know, I think everybody on this call and on the show today, that climate is an issue that affects absolutely every other issue, immigration, income inequality, even violence. There are studies that show that violence increases. Gun violence increases in hot weather. So it's an issue that is intertwined with everything that we do because this is the planet that is the platform on which we live. So the DNC has not exactly elevated climate to the place that it should be, but I also understand that the American electorate is, you know, at least 15 or 20 years behind probably everyone speaking on this show because they have been subjected to this vast and very organized disinformation campaign, and people are only really now starting to catch up, but things are changing incredibly quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think that looking at the past and seeing 30 years of inaction as an exemplar of some kind of human nature that makes it impossible for us to take the appropriate steps to stave off planetary disaster is a real mistake. It's not human nature. It's a particular historical moment that distributed power in a certain way, and that is now over. And so it's up to us to build something new. And I'll just end by saying that the climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, who is an evangelical, I might add, who lives in Texas in a very red state, what she says, and I agree with, the most important climate action you can take is to talk about it. Talk about it with your friends. Talk about it with your neighbors. Talk about it at your workplace. Talk about it when you write letters to the editor. We have to not only keep people's attention on this threat that's bearing down at us, but also make it normal to imagine a life that isn't about the biggest SUV, that isn't about, you know, the biggest house that's heated to 79 degrees in the winter. So talk about climate. That's the best thing that you can do.
Catherine Hayhoe, someone I need to get on this program as well. Dr. Genevieve Absolutely. Gunther, great to have you. Thank you very much, Dr. Gunther.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
Endclimatesilence.org. Abby McHugh Griffith, should we talk soon about what you're asking businesses and everyone else to do in this community?
Absolutely, that'd be great.
I think there's a lot more to talk about.
Oh, definitely.
Well, thank you. And you'll find more at the website, RPCC, which is where?
ROCPCC.org. Is that our website? I think so.
You ought to know that.
Yeah.
ROCPCC. And Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan is the lead minister, and you'll find her at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.